episode of the Slongcast, episode 7 for June 22nd, 2010. I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me in studio today is Ryan Lancey.
Hey, everyone.
All right, so we missed last week. Ryan was on travel for work. So what that means is we have a lot of stuff to talk about this week. So first couple things kind of funny that I thought. I don't know what anybody else thinks about them, but the one story that caught my eye was everybody knows about Amazon and their S3 services. Basically, just a big place in the cloud that if you have a lot of data to store for your application or server or whatever, you can store it on Amazon servers. They'll store it for you. You pay them a little fee. But I thought it was pretty funny. The headline of this story, Amazon Cloud uses FedEx instead of the internet to ship data. Is that, I mean, just without reading the article, that's probably funny, right?
LOL.
And the thing is, and I do this with my, I use CrashPlan to back up all of my data on my server. You know, there's Carbonite, there's CrashPlan, there's a bunch of remote backup services. But Amazon is pretty much doing the same thing, where if you have so much data that it's going to take you weeks to back up over the internet, they will allow you to burn all of your data to CD, DVD, whatever, and literally mail it to them. And then they will put it on their server. So I just thought that was pretty cool. I thought it was funny that the headline, you know, you're using FedEx to store your data instead of the internet.
Well, I mean, it's basically just a bandwidth problem.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, when you got like a massive amount of data to get pushed somewhere, I think that, you know, FedEx is probably the best way to do it. You know, considering that the local data bus on a computer is a zillion times faster than the internet.
Yeah, whenever I first uploaded all of my stuff to CrashPlan, it was between 1 and 200 gigabytes, and it took almost a week to do the initial backup. So, yeah, this using FedEx, giving you that option is definitely a good idea. But I just thought it was funny. I had to bring it up. Caught my eye.
Like I said, LOL.
One thing that is not so funny, though, if you happen to be the owner of an Olympus Stylus Tough 6010 camera, you got a little surprise when you opened up your camera, took some pictures, and plugged the memory card into your computer. Congratulations, you got a virus. So,
not so tough.
I don't know how this happened, but all the cameras, you know, came from Olympus in Japan, and the memory cards that ship with the cameras came with viruses, auto-run viruses, that as soon as you plug this memory card into your computer, if your computer has auto-run turned on and it tries to read that card, your computer will automatically be infected with this virus.
So did it install Windows 95?
Yes, it actually took you back to Windows 3.1.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah, but I mean, wow. I mean, I know, like, you or I never just take a camera out and start shooting. You know, I always format it first just to make sure. Even if I buy a card alone, you know, buy a card from Amazon, first thing I do is format it. I don't trust whatever comes on it. But I can imagine the rest of the world, you know, just grabbing the camera and start shooting, and then they get infected.
Yeah, that kind of sucks. I mean, I think the manufacturers have to do a little more, or have a little more due diligence to be doing. Can I use the word do one more time in a sentence?
Yes, do.
Do. Do-do. I will do that. No, seriously, they have to realize that, you know, these devices are going out to millions of people. You got to make sure your memory cards are clean. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's like, why even include the stinking memory card, honestly? Like, SD cards.
It's so small.
Yeah, well, CF cards, SD cards, all of them. They're like a dollar right now. I mean, for like gigs of space.
Just, and the ones that you get with a camera are only like, you know, a gig, 512 meg. Like, they're
crap. If you're lucky. I think the last one I got, although I bought my camera a while ago, it was like 32 megabytes.
Yeah, like, why even do it?
It's like four pictures.
And I don't know. I can't even begin to imagine how this happened. Like, do they make the memory cards themselves, and do they have like just one Goldmaster stamp that somebody was able to put this virus in and then it just got stamped onto all of the other ones? Or was this, you know, I don't even know how this begins to happen to go onto every card that goes out the door. You know, that's it just amazes me. So if you do have the Olympus Stylus Tough 6010 camera, it's a little point-and-shoot handheld thing, you can go to Olympus's website. Unfortunately, it's the Japanese version of the website that has the serial number checker to tell you if you're vulnerable or not. But if you can read Japanese or, you know, go to Google and have Google translate the page for you, it'll tell you whether your card came with the virus. But yeah, if you have that camera, be careful. It's not a good thing. Or, you know, stop buying Olympus cameras. There are better ones out there. Maybe not cheaper, but better. Next cool thing that I saw over the past 2 weeks is a very cool Firefox extension put out by the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the Tor Project. And the extension is called HTTPS Everywhere. So, Ryan, I'm sure you've seen, you go to log into Gmail, you got to log into Facebook or something, you think you started off as a secure SSL connection, and then the next time you look up at your title bar, all of a sudden it's back to plain HTTP, and all of your stuff is going in plain text.
Yeah, I mean, there's only certain websites and certain parts of certain websites that even support SSL, and which I believe, isn't that called like TLS now or something?
Yeah, SSL was the old original version of encryption. TLS is what it is now. It's the successor to SSL. But either way, the little certificate, the little lock icon you get in the address bar that tells you that your website browsing is secure and data you send is secure. So this extension basically makes sure that at least for certain sites, you are always using that secure connection. You know, because like I mentioned earlier, sometimes, you know, Gmail, Facebook, you start off with HTTPS and then somewhere 5 minutes down the road, it's no longer secure. This plugin will make sure that for a set number of websites, you're always secure. So it's not for everything. You know, it only works for hard-coded sites that they give you. It's only like 10 sites that it works for. But, you know, as they open it up and make it work for more sites, I think this is really awesome. You know, it's definitely something that everybody should have. You don't have to think about it. You install the extension and bam, all of those sites are always secure.
Yeah, I'm not sure why some of these sites don't use the HTTPS by default. I mean, I don't even see Gmail listed here, but that's an option in the Gmail settings is to you can select HTTPS to be the default.
Right. Yeah, Google's been notorious for that. If you go between Gmail to Google Search or to Google Docs or another Google product, it'll just randomly switch between HTTPS and HTTP. You know, it kind of sucks. Just make it standard. Mm-hmm. And going on that same thing, Google actually made Google Search for HTTPS. So normally, if you went to Google to search for something, anything you searched for was sent in plain text. But now, if you even want to cover your search tracks, you can go to https://google.com, and it will cover those so nobody can snoop in on your stuff. So Google's trying.
Yeah, you know, I still think maybe we should take a page from Mark Zuckerberg's, you know, idea of the internet. And if you have nothing to hide, if you're not doing anything wrong, you should have nothing to hide.
Yes. That was a very bad rim shot, but yeah, who cares? Put all your information out there. No big deal. But for those of us who do care, if you run Firefox, go download HTTPS Everywhere. You don't have to think about it. You just install it and it works. And I'm sure that, you know, Chrome and any other Safari, any other browser that supports extensions, this will be ported to those because this is, it's a good extension to have. So definitely be on the lookout for that. Now, this next thing really, really annoyed slash made me mad when I saw the article. So, as we all know, California is not the richest state. You know, they pretty much are deficit, $19 billion deficit. So they're losing a little bit of money, and they're trying to figure out clever new ways to make money. One of those clever new ways is to make your license plate on your vehicle electronic, which you might think, wow, that is freaking awesome. I want that. Until you realize that having one of these electronic plates means that your vehicle will be serving up advertisements as you drive down the road. Can you believe that?
Yeah, that's pretty, atrocious.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like while you're driving, there will be Subway ads flashing. Your car will always show your license plate number until you stop, don't move for 5 seconds. Then it will switch to an ad. So, I mean, while you're sitting there at a stop sign or a stoplight or, you know, stuck in traffic, you're going to be bombarded with ads by the car in front of you with their freaking electronic license plate. I mean, this is... What do you think about that? I mean, just the whole point of electronic license plates to begin with, and then add the ads to it.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I don't know, maybe some promise in finding cars, especially if the license plates use, like, RFID or maybe some kind of, like, you know, low jack support. You know, it'd be nice, you know, if it was like a GPS responder or transponder somehow. But
since you just mentioned that, can you explain a little bit what low jack is for the people who don't?
Low jack is a device. I think they use it in police cars, actually, to locate stolen police cars. And
it's a spin on the word hijack.
Yeah, basically, the car is easily found via the low jack services. I don't know if it broadcasts like an RF signal or if it's just got some kind of GPS like repeater in it, like to repeat its GPS location out via some other service. But I think it's used pretty widely in the police industry for their cars, for the, you know, police cruisers. And I think you can buy it as a consumer for, you know, if you have a car you don't want stolen, or if it does get stolen, it's worth a lot of money to you, like a, I don't know, Lamborghini or something. But I think like some of that same functionality is provided by OnStar.
Right.
But I don't know if it's implemented the same way.
Yeah, I like the idea of what you can do with electronic license plates. I do not like that they're trying to make money on it by shoveling out advertisements.
No, I agree. I think that if the government needs more money, it should raise taxes or it should cut its spending, not sell advertisements.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, be on the lookout. For those of you listening who are in California, you may be seeing this sometime soon. You know,
Steve Jobs, we know you're out there. We know you're listening.
Seriously, he's going to be the one to make ads awesome for license plates. We talked about this last week, Apple being an ad company. I'm sure he's going to be all over that. Okay, so enough about that. Another story that we previously covered was the FCC and net neutrality. Just recently, the FCC started to put into motion its plan. They haven't done anything yet. What they've done right now, they've realized, you know, there's an outcry by what I like to call the idiots out there who don't want net neutrality, don't want the FCC to fix things. But they've realized that they need to come out with some options and not just come out with a heavy hand and do stuff. So they've come out with what they call their three ways that they can move forward to help net neutrality. So the first way is just leave everything alone. The second way is reclassify the internet just like they reclassified the telephone system, using all of the same rules, make it exactly the same. And the third way, which is what they and everyone else seems to think is the best way to go, is to reclassify the internet, but don't use all of the rules, only use some of the rules. So only use the ones that make sense for the internet. So did you hear anything about this? What do you think about, you know, I think it's a good thing that they're at least thinking outside the box a little bit, not coming down with a heavy hand saying, here are some options, let's work together.
Well, I hadn't heard anything specifically about the three ways forward, you know, rolled into one, like, I guess, mission statement or battle plan. But I do, you know, I have heard all three issues separately raised. You know, doing nothing isn't really an option. I think, because there's companies already taking advantage of their position, and we talked about content providers versus service providers and ISPs and how they can, you know, use their leverage as an ISP or service provider to you know, give themselves benefit in the content provider arena. So I think some regulations required. The other part of it that I think the FCC wants to implement one of the things that I think the Telecommunications Act, specifically with telephones, enabled was the remote locations, you know, very rural areas, to get the same level of telephone service as the cities. And this is something that I think was important then, and I think it's important now. The internet is become the replacement, in my opinion, for the old era of telecommunications. It's replacing, you know, broadcast media. It's replacing point-to-point telephone communications.
Yeah, especially for people of our generation.
Yeah.
I don't have a landline. I don't know many people who do anymore.
Neither do I. All I have is a cell phone, which in some ways can be frustrating, especially when your cell phone decides to give up the ghost. But, you know, all that said, I have a Google Voice number, and I could always fall back on that. I have Skype. So there's ways to communicate with people even without the cell phone. But getting back to my point, you know, the United States has a large disparity in the availability of internet services. Even in our area, you know, we have a couple providers. I think Comcast provides something like 5 meg service, and Verizon provides like a 3 meg service. I think actually that might be an option. I think the base rate is like 1500 kbps, but you know, those are pretty good. They're not awesome. By some other country's standards, they're terrible.
Yeah, by Japan's, what is it, minimum 100 megabits?
I think South Korea has a pretty good handle on it there too. There's like 40 or 50 megabit connections that are pretty standard. I don't want to belabor this too much, but you know, basically, I think that the Telecommunications Act and some of the things that the FCC did with telephones specifically enabled widespread use of that, or widespread use and rapid adoption of that technology in the early part of the 20th century. And I think the same type of thing should probably be instituted for the internet.
I completely agree. You know, and like they're saying, they might not be doing it the exact same way they did it for the telephones. You know, they understand that the rules might be a little different, but they understand that there need to be rules. You know, so they're saying we're going to work on this. And like I said, they haven't done anything yet. August 12th is the deadline for this notice of inquiry. So like I said, they put out there 3 ways that they can go forward, and any company, you know, any party who's interested can respond to the FCC, you know, with their opinions by August 12th. And then once August 12th comes, then they're going to make their decision on how they're moving forward. So if any of you people out there listening, you know, work for any big companies, have any pull anywhere, you know, you got time to go talk to the FCC. But definitely look into this, research their position. Don't be one of those people who, you know, have made the TV commercials we've seen in the past couple months, you know, either bashing the FCC or completely for the FCC. You know, research it first, figure out all the points of view, and then, you know, write to them. Let them know what you think. Everybody's opinion counts, and they will read everything. You know, that's their job. They have people there who do that. So definitely let them know what you think. Another cool thing that I saw, which is half awesome for the little kid in me and half freaking scary, is the FAA is looking into, that's the Federal Aviation Administration, the people who control, you know, our commercial flights everywhere. They're looking into unmanned aircraft. So what do I mean by that? Not, you know, the Predator drones that the Army is using to go, you know, spy on people. I'm talking 747 flights from Pittsburgh to Chicago, Pittsburgh to Vegas, without a pilot. You know, they're looking into the what technology, how they can do this to have real commuter planes with hundreds of passengers on board be completely unmanned. So let me just add in my own personal opinion on this. I think that there needs to be somebody capable of flying on the aircraft, because technology will fail. You know, it's not perfect. But I do think that having an unmanned aircraft can keep things safer, because you don't have that human error. Computers are a lot better at these types of things than humans are. You know, the human doesn't have to worry about, am I 1,000 feet, you know, above my airspace that I'm supposed to be in? Are there planes within 3,000 feet of me? You know, you don't have a human deciding on these things. The computer will take care of everything. So personally, I think if they can get this to work well, this would be absolutely perfect.
Well, I think, I mean, from what I read in the article, I don't really think that it's that they're currently looking into replacing pilots in commercial aviation. What this is about is trying to find ways to allow unmanned aircraft to fly in commercial airspace, meaning that an unmanned aircraft might fly alongside a 747 or a 737 or some other, you know, Airbus. I don't think it's so much that they're replacing the pilots. They want to find ways to allow unmanned aircraft to fly in commercial airspace.
I think my idea is a lot better.
Well, I mean, I think they are looking into that as well, but you know, I think a lot of people were interested in that. But the cost of a pilot, you know, isn't really all that much. The reason that unmanned aircraft are so popular in the military was twofold. One, that you're not putting somebody in harm's way, and a lot of times two people, because a lot of aircraft are two-seaters. And then also is that the cost can be reduced. You can make a smaller aircraft, harder to detect. You know, you don't have to spend money on stealth technology. It doesn't have to be so big that it, you know, it just uses all this fuel. It doesn't cost as much if it goes down. You know, I think I remember reading it, like an F-14, which they don't use anymore. They're like $30 million or something, you know, and that was like 20 years ago. So I don't know what a Joint Strike Fighter will cost when those come out, but they're probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's why they're so popular in the military world, because it's reducing risk and cost. You know, commercial flights don't go down every day.
Right.
So they don't need them for that reason. They're not losing planes left and right. And they're also not putting people in danger for that same reason. So I don't think it's so much that they want to replace pilots, though that technology may allow for like even safer. I would argue that, you know, the additional checks that could be put in place from an automatic, you know, flight system or a better autopilot may enhance airline safety. But this is really about allowing unmanned aircraft to fly in commercial airspace. So currently, if like a Predator drone wants to fly in the United States, I think it has to have special airspace and all the other stuff. And I think that's where the conflict is, because the system that allows avoidance of those of wrecks, it's called TCAS. It's the Traffic Alert and Collision Avoidance System. That system was developed at a very high cost, and it was under the assumption that the aircraft that it would be trying to avoid would not be automatically piloted. They'd be piloted by people. So there's certain prediction algorithms that it uses to understand how to move the aircraft to get out of the other aircraft's way. So they want to find a way to allow these unmanned aircraft to fly in the same space without upgrading the TCAS system, and that could be really expensive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're talking about putting more money into, you know, continuing to develop the TCAS system. And one thing that the article pointed out specifically, which I'm sure anybody who's been on vacation down to Florida has seen, you know, if you go to Miami or somewhere and you get on your flight back home, you don't take off and go straight over land. You take off over the Atlantic Ocean, and you're over the ocean for the first 5 minutes of your flight, and then all of a sudden you zigzag back in over land. So, you know, as a sub-step between, you know, what the article is actually about and what I want it to be about, you know, upgrading the TCAS system to eliminate those zigzag routes and make planes able to go more point-to-point in a straight line, you know, that's also cost savings. You know, that's fuel. They're mm-hmm. saving fuel. They're saving people's time. So I think as a first step, that is awesome. I don't want to fly over an ocean. I mean, I don't think I'm going to wreck, but I don't know. If I'm going to wreck, I want it to be on land. I don't want to drown. I would rather smash into hard ground than drown.
Hmm.
Yeah, not cool to talk about, but okay, so enough of dying.
Agreed.
So I don't know what to say about this next one because I do not use Bing for my search engine. Although for those people who do use Bing, you know what I'm talking about when I say like the background image. You know, you go to Bing and you every day there's a new, very high quality, very cool looking background image that you're presented with.
It's awesome.
So for those of us who use Google, you know, we never had that white background. However, one day last week, those of us went to Google and all of a sudden, bam, high res background. What is going on? The internet was literally in uproar. This was only supposed to be a 24-hour thing that Google was testing out. You know, oh, you know, what's going to happen if we put a background image on? It was only after like 13 hours or something, they got so many complaints. They're like, okay, we give up. We're taking it away. Back to the white background. So what do you think of Google's Bing-esque look?
Well, I was one of the people, I think I missed the initial rollout, but then I saw the option to actually, you know, put it up on my homepage, and I did. I took advantage of that, and I picked some image of, like, some city skyline at night, because I like skylines, but I like it. I mean, one of the things that attracted me to Bing early on, as silly as it may seem, is the background. It's a visually appealing interface. I think that's one place that Microsoft did a lot of their homework. You know, aesthetics are a big thing, as is evidenced by the success of Apple's products. So, you know, I think Bing took a or Microsoft took a you know, a note there and was able to, you know, create a visually appealing page that, you know, stood out against the competition. And that's not to mention that the results you get in Bing are very comparable, if not better in some cases, than Google. You know, there's certain things when you search for, you seem to get maybe not hot topics, but more relevant results to your, you know, to your search. And I think that's, you know, that's one place that the search engines have been, not to get them too much of a tangent, but they've been, you know, fighting with the hot topic type.
Integrating Twitter and
Twitter things. Live search and all this other stuff, you know, live feeds. And I think that, you know, when you look at what Bing does, it seems to produce more relevant results in some cases, not in all. But the larger aspect is I think that, you know, Google hadn't had much of a overhaul, you know, since its inception in the mid to late 90s. You know, they were due, and I think the way in which they did it was a very obvious copy,
a complete copy. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, now the same could be said for some of what Bing did. You know, Bing has you search for something, and then after you search for it, there's links for, you know, maps and images and videos, which is something that Google had added years ago to their page. So. I think, you know, it's sort of on both sides of the fence. You know, both companies have done a little bit of copying here and there, but hey, I think it makes Google more attractive. It's, you know, it's not as boring looking when you go there. it's a little more customizable. I don't know if anyone else has used iGoogle. I've used iGoogle for a long time.
I used to use it, but then I found another service page that did this similar thing, so I got away from iGoogle.
Yeah, iGoogle let you put in a, not a background picture, but a header. There was a header, you know, behind the Google background, and you could put on little widgets for, like, weather and news and that sort of stuff. So I had been using that years ago. I've since ceased using it, but, you know, it wasn't a real striking change to me since I used iGoogle, but I still liked it.
Yeah, the thing that got me, I think it's just more because Google had always said, you know, they want their page to load the fastest. They want their main search page to be the fastest. You come to it, it is literally the smallest size in bytes that they can make it. And, you know, they would put out press releases before of, hey, we reworded the search button, so we shaved off 1.2 bytes, so now our page loads more. You know, they were all about that. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, bam, here's a 1 megabyte, you know, homepage. I that's what really got me about it, is that from the people who try to keep their page as slim as possible, complete 180 and make it, you know, high def pictures. But yeah, I mean, to each their own. You can turn it off if you want. You know, I turn it off. Normally, I don't even see that, because I use the Google bar that's integrated into Firefox or integrated into Safari, so I never really see the homepage of Google. So I would think that most people don't see that. But yeah, it was kind of funny. You know, the internet told Google what's up, and they're like, okay, we'll change. So continuing on with Google, we talked about last week or the week before, I think it was last week, about Google collecting that Wi-Fi data from the Street View cars over in Germany. Well, they did it again. It's a little Britney Spears moment here. In Connecticut this time. So I don't know what to say about this. I don't have enough information to say Google is a bad company for doing this, or whether they just happened to load up their GS Lite software. GS Lite is the name of the software that they have do the Wi-Fi stuff on their Street View cars. Whether they loaded up that same software on every Street View car, so it's in every city, and Connecticut just happened to be the second city where they got in trouble for it. You know, I don't know what to say, but it's interesting that this hits the news again, that Google was in trouble again for collecting this Wi-Fi traffic. So
I still question their claims that it's illegal.
Oh, it's totally not.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of overreaction. I understand people's, you know, desire to have some privacy, and I think that privacy should be respected, and I think it should be provided, or at least the control should be provided. That said, you know, hey, if you're broadcasting your, you know, bank account information, and you're using an outdated old encryption protocol that is, you know, easily defeated, too bad. You know, wake up, smell the roses. You got to pay for the technology that it protects your data, or wise up. You know, and I think anyone could be collecting that data. You're lucky that, you know, Google's even, you know, acknowledging this and working with authorities. I really don't think Google's going to circumvent this. You know, time will tell if this turns into something, but they're not a stupid company.
Yeah, I mean, they came out and said, yes, we did this, and they gave up all of their information to a third-party auditing company, Straus Friedberg, I believe was the name of the company, and this third-party company came in and audited the GS Lite software and all of the data that they collected, and basically when the audit was over, this company came back and said, hey, Google's in the clear. You know, they did nothing wrong. We see that they've stored this data, but they disregarded encrypted data. They weren't breaking anything. We looked through the code, and the code only tries to do the mappings that we talked about before, you know, seeing where this data came from, GPS locations, things like that. They weren't trying to steal any data. So, you know, they're cooperating with literally everybody. Third-party auditors said they are in the clear. So, and especially, I mean, the software, this also came out of the audit. The GS Lite software uses Kismet. Kismet's an open source wireless cracking program, wireless capturing program. And they had it configured to jump access points 5 times per second. So can you imagine how little data they gathered from each person's access point if their software connects to your access point for 1/5 of a second? You know, for those people out there that are worried about this, there's not much data you can grab, not many packets you can grab in 1/5 of a second before their software disconnects from your access point and connects to the next one that it sees. So, yeah, I don't think there was any bad in this at all. But let me point out, for those of you out there who use wireless, here are some tips that you should do if you don't want to be an idiot. First one, use HTTPS. Every website you go to, Facebook, bank websites, Amazon, make sure your address bar says HTTPS. Make sure you have that lock. If you look at the address bar or the bottom of your screen and you have a lock with a line drawn through it, or in Internet Explorer, you get the pop-up that says parts of this page may not be encrypted. What that really means is the entire page is not encrypted. If you ever get that message or ever see the lock with a slash through it, your entire session is unencrypted. No matter if it tells you half is and half isn't, everything isn't. Your data is out there. So use HTTPS, make sure it's working. And if you have wireless in your house, don't use WEP, don't use WPA, don't use WPA2 with TKIP. If you have the option, use WPA2 with AES encryption. I know this is getting a little technical, but you have the option when you go plug in your wireless router. You can go in and set this. Use WPA2 with AES encryption. That is the only one that people haven't cracked yet. So I'm not saying it's not going to happen tomorrow, but that is the only one that you are guaranteed safe with. So, you know, HTTPS, use WPA2 with AES encryption. If you don't do that, you're asking for your stuff to be stolen. You know, I think Ryan said it right. You know, get up with the times, realize you're on the internet on a public place giving out your private information. So you got to educate yourself a little bit. So that's all I wanted to talk. I don't know if you want to talk any more about that, about the Wi-Fi stuff. So a nicer thing in the Google realm is they just recently released their newest version of their Android operating system, which is for cell phones, you know, smartphones, Google Android 2.2 Froyo, which is codenamed for frozen yogurt. And it's kind of funny, I guess they're using food or desserts specifically as their code names, because Android 2.3 is codenamed gingerbread.
Yeah, the 2.0, well, I can't remember exactly all the releases, but one was donut, one was eclair, one was cupcake.
Mm.
Yes, they're all tasty.
I just had a Homer Simpson moment there.
Everyone knows I like donuts.
Yeah, so 2.2 Froyo seems to be their biggest release yet of Android. You know, it's much faster. They redesigned the interface. I don't want to say to be more iPhone-like, but that's really what they did. They made things make sense a little more. Like the one bar they added at the bottom gives you constant access to the phone and the web browser. Those buttons never disappear. You can tether without hacking it or doing anything special. It's just a built-in option, so your laptop can use your cell phone as an internet connection. It has Flash. For those people, you know, on the iPhones, you will never have Flash. So half the internet doesn't work for you. But, you know, Android has Flash. Flash 10.1, I believe, was just released for Android. So, yeah, Froyo, for those of you out there with an Android, you know, HTC Incredible, a Motorola Droid, HTC Evo, you know, any phone out there that runs the Android operating system, this will be a very good thing to update. So if you're afraid of it, you know, definitely get it. You know, we were talking earlier, Ryan, none of us have seen 2.2 in action. Yeah, so unfortunately we can't talk intelligently about this other than telling you, if you have an Android phone, go get it, because it's going to be worth the time.
Yeah, the I watched the Google I/O keynote, and they talked about Froyo there. One of the features that caught my eye is it's escaping my mind right now, the name of it, but basically it's a way to control Froyo from a distance over the internet is the best way I can describe it. So, like, one thing you can do is go to the Android App Store and you buy an app, right? So typically if you buy an app, and now I'm talking about, let's say we're on a PC and we're doing this. We go to the app store on a PC, we buy it. Typically, most systems, you just download the app and then you have to sync it to your phone later. Well, with this new feature, you can push the update or the updated application or the new application right to the phone. And there's this API available now that Froyo implements that allows this to happen. And those actions that do that, they have a name. I'm trying to find it right now, and I'm having trouble locating it.
Yeah, so basically, like, you could keep your phone on your desk at home, and while you're at work, you could log into the Android Marketplace, buy an application, and it will automatically get sent to your phone. And when you get home, that application will be there without you ever touching your phone. So that's a really, really cool feature. And unfortunately, I'm with you. I don't remember the name of it. But yeah, that's, you know, with the iPhone, with other phones, you can either buy applications on the phone, so you have to have it in your hand, or you have to get the application downloaded on your computer and then sync it. So either way, there's a lot of, not interference, a lot of interfacing done by you, whereas this lets you do it whether you have your phone or not. So it may seem a minuscule thing to most people, but it's really cool. It's a step in the right direction of allowing you to use your phone and use the features of your phone, even if it's not right in front of you. So no luck finding the name?
No, I'm looking. I can't locate it.
Well, if you find it, just, you know, interrupt me later. We'll move on to it.
We'll do.
So keeping with the mobile topic, this article struck me a little bit. Kind of funny and really? That's what I thought while I was reading it. But I'll take any opportunity to bash Microsoft. But Microsoft has a couple mobile operating systems for phones. And this article basically took my tone. You know, they were pretty much making fun of Microsoft because they have so many. I mean, you look at Apple, they have the iPhone OS, or what they now call iOS. You look at Google, they have Android. You look at Palm, well, they have a couple now. They have WebOS, and then they have the older version, Palm. So Palm has two. But you look at Microsoft now, and I wrote down all of them so that I wouldn't forget them. Microsoft has Windows Embedded CE, Windows Mobile 6.5, Windows Embedded Handheld OS, Windows Embedded Compact 7 OS, and Windows Phone 7. So I'm sure that's probably not a complete list, but Microsoft has five distinct operating systems for mobile devices. So what do you think about this, Ryan? Do you think this is a misstep on their part, having so many distinct things, or do you think that they're just trying to fill out a market?
Well, you know, at first it definitely looks like, oh, they've got, you know, they don't know what they're doing. They're never good at marketing, and just like the name Windows Phone 7 series, it just rolls off the tongue. But yeah,
Windows Embedded Compact 7 OS, really?
Yeah, I mean, but we have to realize that there's a lot of hardware out there that runs Windows CE. I think we talked about this on a previous podcast. Like, what they have, you know, there's electronic digital oscilloscopes, set-top boxes.
Right, not just phones.
Yeah, not just phones. Yeah. You know, there's all kinds of handheld devices that, you know, little like portable PDA-type things, medical-type devices. You know, even like, I think, you know, a lot of the, a friend of mine reminded me of this a couple days ago, there's a lot of GPS navigation devices that run Windows CE in the background. I have a GPS device by a company called Navigon. They're a European company. They've since ceased selling their devices in the U.S., mainly just because they've been forced out from competition. But I've used a lot of different brands, TomTom, Magellan, Garmin, and I think Navigon was one of the better ones. And it ran on Windows CE. Now, that was hidden to the user. But my point is that, you know, everyone sort of makes fun of this operating system that Microsoft has, but it runs these like time critical, you know, devices out there, and there's a lot of market segmentation there. You know, I think if you counted up all the devices that run Windows CE, and maybe this isn't a fair comparison, but it would probably outstrip Apple's portable OSs by a factor of 10 to 1, maybe more. I mean, there are just like bucket loads of these devices that use Windows CE. Now, they definitely are kind of creating a little bit of a, you know, some confusion with all this naming. I think that's probably their biggest guffaw is just to the way they've named them. The, you know, the Windows Mobile 7 or Windows Phone 7 series and Windows Mobile 6.5. I mean, Windows anything 7 is just a successor to the previous version. So I don't think you can really – that's like calling iOS or iPhone OS 3.0 and iOS 4.0 two different OSs.
Right.
So I think, you know, right there you just split that list that you wrote off in half. And then the addition – the two other OSs are – you know, they're geared towards enterprise type applications. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word enterprise, I was actually kind of saddened. A very big staunch Microsoft supporter wrote an article about this, and I think he totally missed the boat on it. That we hear enterprise and you think Outlook. Well, wrong. You know, there's markets out there where, like, think about UPS. And FedEx, they carry around these little devices that you sign on, and it keeps track of all the shipments and all that type of stuff. I don't know what those devices run, but there are tons of companies with those types of devices, and they run Windows CE, and they're meant to, you know, enable the employees as they travel. So, if people complain about Windows sometimes about how much is inside of it, and there's so much crap that comes along with it. This is Microsoft providing a couple different OSs for different purposes, and I think one of them is for these enterprise applications where you need something that's really lightweight, speedy, can be custom developed on. You don't have to follow as many rules as you would with, you know, Windows Phone. This, in my opinion, this is like brilliance in that I see coming from Microsoft. They're going to segment their OS for the phone devices, which will probably be more tightly controlled with a regulated app store, much like Microsoft is doing, and opening up their other OS for these custom built devices for these purpose built devices. So I think I really think it's a non issue, you know. And then the fifth one on that list was Windows CE. Just in general, Windows CE is the core for all of these. It's the kernel that runs behind, even underneath Windows. Windows Phone 7, it has a CE core. So
yeah, you're right, but there actually was an OS Windows CE.
Oh, there still is. I mean, yeah. Some of the bigger devices that aren't portable use Windows CE. Right. I think actually the Tech Scopes use Windows CE.
Yeah, I don't know if I go as far as you did calling it brilliance, because I still think about, you know, what they did with Vista and especially with Vista, that they tried to do what you said with, you know, this comes with all this bloat. So instead of giving you an operating system with 10,000 things you don't need, we're going to give you the choice between 6. And that really ended up not being brilliant, but confusing the end user as to which one do I need to get which functionality. So whereas in this enterprise space, I don't see that being as much of a problem. People really know what they need a little more, and they can pick the right version. But I don't know, Windows embedded handheld, Windows embedded compact 7, you know, just looking at it, I don't know what the difference is. I think splitting the mobile device operating system and the phone operating system, perfect move. You know, you definitely want to do that. But even within the mobile device, I think they might just have too many. I don't know. Obviously, they're making a lot of money, so what I think doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple would love to have these problems, really. I mean, in some ways, because even though the Windows Phone market share is probably well below 10% now, they have a corner on the rest of the world. I mean,
and their stuff runs everything.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, it really does. And I think, you know, Linux is making some grounds there, but are gaining some ground there. But, you know, These Microsoft knows how to make money at software. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at things that are not mission, things that are time critical, like power grids, you know, those run Unix variants, real-time operating systems. Everything else that isn't time critical runs Windows CE, you know, or some version of a Microsoft OS. So you're right. They make a lot of money on this crap. So, yeah, it might be confusing to us, but I'm sure in the market, these people know exactly what they're doing. So the next thing is about AT&T. I think you added this article.
Yeah, I think this is absolute crap, by the way.
I totally agree. Do you want to explain it?
Yeah, okay. So everybody knows how terrible AT&T service is, you know, in a lot of instances, especially 3G. So they started offering this like little thing they call a microcell or a femtocell. I don't know.
Yeah, femtocell is a technology. Microcell was their product name.
Oh, okay. So basically what it is it's just a repeater. You stick this thing in your house. You attach it to your internet, whatever it may be, cable, DSL, dial-up.
I think it has to be high speed.
Okay, it's got to be high speed. So, you know, whatever you have, Verizon Fios or cable or, you know, maybe you pony it up for a T1. You got this high-speed connection. So you hook the AT&T microcell to it. And what it does is it generates an AT&T-compatible 3G, GSM, you know, HSPDA, blah, 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 like connection for your phone or your mobile, your smartphone or whatever. Now, you can use it for whatever you want. You can make calls. You can download data. You can send text messages. But mind you, the only reason you'd be buying this is if the AT&T hasn't done their job and the service at your house is just terrible. You're in a hole or you live, you know, 20 miles from civilization and it's just you don't get any service. That's why you get this thing. That said, great service, right? You know, you pay for it monthly and you buy this device. Guess what? All the data that you download via this thing and the minutes that you use talking on the phone count against your caps. So if you download a Linux ISO on your iPhone via this femtocell, you know, it's going to count against your 2 gigabyte cap, or I guess in some cases it's unlimited.
Well, everything from now on is 2 gigabyte or 250 meg.
Yeah, depending on which service level you get. Yeah. And if you call Aunt Sally and talk to her for 100 minutes or something, an hour and a half, on your femto or your microcell that's connected to your bandwidth, you connected it to your internet, it takes away from your minutes. You know, if you have 900 minutes or 450 minutes, it counts against it. Now, I would hope that they've applied the nights and weekends limitation or nights and weekends, you know, to this so that it doesn't use your cap at night. But I don't even know that for sure. But AT&T, you know, they've interviewed them. Well, I don't know. What do you think, Kev?
No, I mean, your first point is totally right. The only reason you buy one of these is because AT&T sucks in the first place. So it's expensive, and I believe I don't know if you buy it or if you rent it from them. Do you know?
I'm not sure. You probably can do either, but
yeah. Either way, it's expensive just to get one of these. It's basically a mini tower. You're putting up an AT&T tower inside your house. Now, the thing that it uses your caps, your minutes, and your data, that is absolute total crap, because you are not using the AT&T airwaves to hit a real tower, so you're not taking up any of that bandwidth. B, you are not using the AT&T backhaul from the tower across the fiber to the co-location, you know, into the grid. You're not using that because everything is going over your home internet connection. There is absolutely no reason anything you do when your phone is connected to this microcell should count against your caps. I mean, this is an absurd technology. However, it is a much-needed technology for people who live either in the sticks or inside of, you know, New York or San Francisco, or just in buildings with really thick walls that the signal doesn't get into.
Yeah, I mean, there's the article, the person that wrote the article commented that they think the reason that they're doing this is because they just can't, differentiate between calls and data originated from one of these microcells over the internet versus their own towers, which may very well be the case.
I find that really hard to believe.
Well, I mean, having experience dealing with AT&T billing, they don't know their butt from a hole in the ground.
That so is true.
I don't put it past them because they were always unable to tell whether I was roaming or not, and then I would get slapped with roaming charges 2 to 3 months later. So that said, I think what it really boils down to is that this is the same kind of thing as them enabling Skype and VoIP apps on the 3G network over Wi-Fi. They don't want you to have this ability. They want you to use, for certain things, they want you to use their network or pay some egregious fee so that they're not missing out on revenue. And I think it's bullshit. Explicit tag, damn it.
Did it again. Yeah, I mean, if you want to use one of these things and you don't want it to go against your cap, you have to pay another $20 a month to get unlimited non-cap minutes. And then I believe it's another fee, and probably another $20 if you want unlimited data. So not only are you paying, you know, for smartphone users, you're paying close to $100 a month anyways for a phone, the service that can do voice and data. Then if you have the microcell, you're paying $150 for this microcell. And then if you want the microcell to not go against your minutes, you're paying another $40 a month. I mean, you're having a $150 phone bill a month, all because AT&T sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I think AT&T and the rest of these companies, they need to really start to think about their business models, because it's not going to be far off. I mean, if the FCC gets their way and this national broadband plan gets pushed through, you know, a lot of communities are standing up free Wi-Fi. It may not be inconceivable that there's a grid fabric there that's completely autonomous and does not need their towers or backhaul. You know, there's already been a couple phones out there that were VoIP phones, they're wireless VoIP phones.
Yeah, any smartphone that you can download the Fring application,
yeah,
you know, that gives you access to every VoIP service ever.
Yeah, I think if they don't watch it, they're going to completely lose out. You know, because people will just have so much; they'll only tolerate so much of this. You know, they're really just, I think, digging themselves a hole.
Yeah, I mean, this used to be, you know, like the hippie factor back in the 60s and 70s. You know, people, you know, going against the government, but they really couldn't do anything. But nowadays, especially with technology, people can do things, and they can choose not to use AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, T-Mobile. They can choose not to use those big companies and find other ways to do it that will work perfectly for them. So yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I don't know what to say. Like I said before, I don't know enough about, you know, what AT&T's main problem is to say whether this is a step in the right direction or a step in the wrong direction, but it's total crap the way they're going about it.
Yeah, I mean, like it or not, you know, we already talked about this. You know, what's on the air, what you collect on the airwaves in the United States, it's open source. You're allowed to, you know, receive airwaves, and the entire RF spectrum in the United States is a public trust. That's how it's considered. It's a public trust. The licenses are granted to these companies because they can provide a service in the best interest of the public. That's how we've viewed the RF spectrum since it's been regulated ever, you know, starting in the first part of the 20th century. That said, all it's going to take are routers that can act as repeaters for some sort of switched wireless fabric that will operate at a higher speed with lower latency. And I don't think this technology is far off. And I don't, you know, we've all heard about Wi-Fi mesh networks and other types of things. All it takes is one of those technologies to really take off, and AT&T and Verizon and the rest of them are out of business.
We can only hope for that day.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, because once you don't need fiber to, you know, then, and the airwaves are a public trust, all it's going to take is an outcry from the people to relax the FCC's restriction on certain parts of bandwidth, you know, and we'll take that 700 megahertz back. Thank you very much. You know, it's just, that's how it works. They have to realize that they're using a shared resource. Don't abuse it.
Okay, so enough bashing on AT&T.
No, never enough.
Well, we're going to keep bashing. But
just for today, okay.
A little bit of this bashing is now going to be put on Apple. If you've watched... Yeah, Ryan was just about to make fun of me there. If you watched the Worldwide Developers Conference, WWDC, you saw Steve Jobs demonstrate the iPhone 4. And he wanted to do really intense demonstrations using Wi-Fi, you know, actually showing him using the phone as a normal person would use it, not just, you know, pre-made slideshows or anything. And he had problems. The same problems that they had at Google I.O. with Bluetooth not working, Steve Jobs had with Wi-Fi not working. Well, a little report came out that someone found out that not all of the problem, but most of the problem with his iPhone 4 demonstration was that the drivers, the Wi-Fi drivers in the iOS 4 that Steve Jobs was using were bad. So I thought that was kind of funny and just a little bashing on Apple that, you know, they couldn't get their stuff straight for their biggest demonstration of the year.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit of, I don't know, maybe it's sour grapes on the on Microsoft's part, you know, on my part as a Microsoft fan. But, you know, it's like everybody's prone to these problems, and it's just a little bit more evidence that, you know, they're not perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of funny. You see all the Apple fanboys storing Google I.O., which was only a couple weeks before WWDC, and they're like, oh, that would never happen with our products. And then here comes WWDC, and bam.
Yeah, the article on Ars Technica goes into a little more detail. I think they interviewed a couple people who are really well-versed in the Wi-Fi chipsets and the network stack and how it all works, and from their perspective they felt that it may even be a bug in the chip that would have to be sort of patched.
So like a ROM?
Yeah, well, a ROM or
firmware update,
firmware, but yeah. it may just be something that they have to like kind of work around, because it's actually a hardware defect and they're not going to go and reproduce, you know, a zillion Wi-Fi chipsets. I mean, there are definitely hardware bugs all the time that are patched by software. You know, the software just has to be aware of the bug and work around it. So it's just interesting that it could possibly be that type of that problem. I mean, it seems to only be a problem in very RF-dense environments. And they said in the article there were like 500 Wi-Fi networks. But I can tell you right now, none of the news outlets had any trouble, the tech news outlets, getting these updates posted while the conference was going on, and they were all using the MiFi devices.
So. Right, literally everybody had a Verizon MiFi,
yeah,
or a Sprint home base. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah,
so over 500 literal wireless access points in there, and that's what caused the trouble. You know, the same with the Bluetooth trouble. You know, the RF spectrum was just congested, mm-hmm. So the same thing happened here. But I just thought it was funny that this did happen to Apple.
I kind of picture Bill Gates sitting back in his recliner watching the Apple keynote stuff stream through, just sort of saying, LOL.
Bill Gates probably was flying his Rafflecopter. For those of you who don't know what a Rafflecopter is, go look it up. It's nothing bad. It's just an internet meme. So the next thing, which continuing with the Apple bashing, anybody who bought an iPad, your security was breached. So here's the deal with this. Phones, iPads, whatever, dishwashers, they all have serial numbers that are printed on the device. All you got to do is look at it and you get the serial number, you know, the ID number, everything has it. It's plain and visible. It's not hidden to anybody. Now, whenever you go to log into your AT&T account on an iPad, AT&T thought they would try to be nice. They would program their web service to automatically grab your serial number from the device, hit their database, match the serial number with the email address that you bought the device with, that you originally registered with, and pre-fill in the login form. So all you needed to do was type in your password. So on the outside, you think, this is awesome. You know, if I want to go sign into AT&T's site, all I need to do is type my password. Everything else is pre-filled. Great. The problem with that is they left this wide open to anybody. So a group of hackers, Goatsy Security, do not look that one up. But they found this web service running on AT&T servers, and pretty much all they did was write some automated scripts to go through and check serial numbers one by one. You know, they start off with the serial number of all zeros. Then they start off with 00001, 00002, and they just kept going and kept going and kept going. Then they had these automated scripts just check every one and spit back the email address that was registered with it. So why is this a big deal? Well, this showed them everybody who bought iPads. So they found people, high levels within the government.
They know who you are.
Yeah, I mean, the president, I mean, people in high levels of all sectors, all companies, they know anybody with an iPad, and they now have data to hack further and get their personal information. So even though I say this is Apple bashing, this is really more AT&T bashing. Yeah, I promise it. Here it is. You know, why would they leave a web service like this open? You think at the minimum they would have, you know, some sort of DMZ firewall or something only allowing access from, like, the iPad 3G set of IP addresses. You think they would do something to secure this? I mean, what do you think about this?
Well, I mean, I really wonder if it was an AT&T thing or if Apple directed them to have this data pre-filled out. I'd really like to – I'd be interested to know who directed that.
Right, root cause, who started it.
Yeah, root cause. And then, I mean, it'd be interesting to see if that person was from Apple, if they got fired yet. Because I can tell you right now, if they didn't close the loop, they are probably – they probably did get canned.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet that it probably was somebody from Apple. I mean, Apple's all about usability, and they probably said, we need this to be the least amount of work for our people as possible. So it probably was, but I think the fault is still on AT&T for leaving this wide open public web service that any Joe Schmo can hit. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that.
Shame on you, AT&T.
Again, you suck. Yet, I bought an iPhone 4, and I will continue to use AT&T for the next 2 years. Okay, so more problems with Apple. Man, this seems like the AT&T and Apple bashing show. Basically, there's been a big company known as AdMob, and AdMob has been the leader in mobile advertising. So if you've ever used any smartphone, you know, applications on a smartphone that have had integrated ads, you know, small banner ads or something within the application, 99% of the time those ads have come from the AdMob network. They are the largest. They make the most money. Well, Apple and the iPhone applications have been using them for all of their apps forever, you know, ever since you were allowed to do that in their apps. But just recently, Google bought AdMob. As soon as that happened, Apple changed their terms of service in such a way that, let's see, how do they say that? Earlier this week, Apple banned developers from using advertising in their iPhone applications that shares analytic data with, quote, an advertising service provider owned by or affiliated with a developer or distributor of mobile devices, mobile operating systems, or development environments other than Apple. What does that mean? Google, now that you bought AdMob, we are not letting you on our platform. So now, any iPhone application cannot use ads from AdMob anymore because the data, the analytic data that comes from those ads will be going to Google, and Google, now that they have Android, is a competitor to Apple. So the FTC... Federal Trade Commission is investigating Apple, you know, to see whether this is illegal. So what do you think about this, Ryan?
Well, you know, everybody was laughing, you know, years ago at Microsoft when they got into their antitrust case. And I think this is a similar type of thing with Apple. You know, they haven't learned these lessons because they've never been quite as big as Microsoft has. You know, AT&T's been in this situation before. I don't know if, you know, AT&T's pretty big right now, but at one time they were, you know, even bigger. You know, they owned all the telephone service in the United States pretty much. And I don't know if it was the FTC specifically, but the federal government split them apart into the baby bells.
Yeah, no more Ma Bell.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where you get all these, you know, the local Bell services. And then what happened with AT&T is that they AT&T merged or was bought by Southwestern Bell Corporation, which was SBC. And when SBC merged, or when they bought AT&T, they took AT&T's name and blah, blah, blah. So now they're back to where they kind of were before as a large conglomerate. So, you know, but I guess Apple hasn't learned these lessons yet. And, you know, this kind of anti-competitive behavior is just, it's, you know, it's kind of, this would be basically like Microsoft putting in their terms of service that only applications developed using Microsoft's tools will be allowed on the Microsoft Windows OS. You know,
and let's not forget that that's exactly what Apple did.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially.
They did that too.
Yeah, essentially banning, you know, like you wouldn't even be able to probably have iTunes on your PC because I don't think they develop iTunes with Visual Studio, which is a Microsoft product. They probably develop it with like some custom tools or some other compiler. They might author parts of it in Visual Studio, and I don't know any specifics on it. But the point is that, you know, while it may seem really unfair in that arena, it's just as unfair in this other arena because really Google is an advertising company. They always have been. And, you know, I think Apple's using their market prowess in one segment to act on another segment, and I think that's unfair.
Yeah, I mean, they did this recently. You know, they just did this with Google and AdMob, and like I said before, they did that with Adobe. You know, like you said, with it would be like Microsoft saying you can't write an application for Windows if you don't use Visual Studio. Well, Apple did that, and they said you cannot write an application for the iPhone OS unless you use our Xcode environment. The reason they did that is because Adobe put into their development, into their Flash development tools, a way that if you make a Flash application, since Flash can't run on the iPhone, there was going to be a one-click exporter to convert a Flash application into a native iPhone application. And once Apple learned about this, they changed their terms of service and said, no applications unless they're made by Apple Studio, you know, Apple's version of Visual Studio, Xcode. So, yeah, this is twice now that Apple has done a sort of anti-competitive thing, and now, you know, they're being looked into by the FTC.
Yeah, I can tell you right now that this would not have been an issue 2 years ago, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, because Apple did not have the market capitalization they do right now.
It's because they're big now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if anyone knows this. I think we might have talked about it. Apple surpassed, finally actually surpassed Microsoft in market capitalization, including the non-public shares, making them the second largest company in the United States, right behind Exxon Mobil, in terms of market capitalization. And anyone who's not familiar with that, it's just the number of shares times the share price. So if you have, you know, 2 million shares and your share price is $40, that's $80 million of market capitalization. So basically, what it boils down to is now they're top dog in the tech industry, so they're going to be the target for this kind of stuff.
Right, a lot more scrutiny than they have ever seen before. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if antitrust comes to Apple now. You know, there's going to be a movie called Apple Antitrust, like there was a movie before just called Antitrust about Microsoft. So yeah, they've been playing ball a little dirty in the past. They're still playing a little dirty, and they're now getting their hands slapped for it, and they're going to have to change. I mean, maybe they think they're still the cool kids product, that maybe they don't have to play by the same rules because they're not as big as Microsoft, but like you said, now they're bigger. So yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, nothing has happened with it yet, So more to come in the future once the FTC and possibly even the DOJ, you know, looks into this. So let's move on and get away from bashing Apple. And two cool things. So the first cool thing, for those of you who were aware of Apple TV, you knew that it really was never mainstream. You know, Steve Jobs even said, and I quote, "It's a hobby." You know, they never really wanted Apple TV to turn into this huge thing that they had to support forever and constantly make awesomer. So they kind of got rid of it, but they've always had the Mac Mini. And the Mac Mini, same size as the Apple TV. It's just a super small desktop computer that only has a CD drive and a couple ports on the back. And it's about, what is it, 6 inches by 6 inches by 2 inches. You know, super thin and really small. It's mini, hence the name. But a lot of people wanted to use that to replace the Apple TV because this was a full-featured computer. It ran Mac OS X. But you could never do that because it never had the video ports. So now you can do it. The new version that Apple just introduced of the Mac Mini has an HDMI port. So that means you can connect it up to your HDTV and get, you know, perfect 1080p signals from your Mac Mini to your TV. And another cool thing, I don't want to sound like an idiot because I didn't know this, but I'm going to sound like an idiot because I didn't know this. But I just looked at my Mac and I was looking through the applications and I saw this application called Front Row. And it had, the icon for it was like the theater curtain that you see on a stage. I'm like, what is this? I had never heard of it before. So I double clicked it and it opened up. It is a home theater, a home theater PC interface. I mean, you open it up and you get options for, you know, music, television, movies, podcast. I mean, it looks like, I don't know whether they just integrated this with the most recent update to Mac OS X that I just recently got a couple days ago, but yeah, I mean, the Mac Mini now has completely replaced the Apple TV. It has HDMI port, it has the HTPC style interface that you can turn on. So I think this is, I don't know, what do you think about this? Do you think Apple was now trying, they realized that the Apple TV was a good product? And now they're just trying to integrate it with a Mac Mini so they don't have many devices to work with. Do you think they're still trying to move in that HTPC direction?
Well, I've always been intrigued a little bit by the Apple TV, the concept, and the Mac Mini for a few reasons. They definitely seem to have merged this, though. I don't think the price point on the Mac Mini is quite what the TV, Apple TV was. I think the Apple TV was like, what, a couple $100?
Yeah, it was maybe $300 or $400. The Mac Mini, yeah. The lowest price is $700.
Yeah, it's a bit pricier. And if anyone out there has ever tried to build an HTPC, a home theater PC, you can do a lot better price-wise. This is not like a revelational price. It's actually a little bit high, I'd say, especially since it doesn't include any tuners. And it doesn't include a remote.
And only half a terabyte of storage.
Yeah, the storage thing. I mean, I think with anything, you know, you'd have to buy external storage for whatever device you buy. But so you're right, though. It's only half terabyte. That's enough to get you started. But in about probably 2-3 months, you'll be wanting some more storage if you like to save 4 or 5 seasons of Lost on your hard drive. So I like the idea that somebody's starting to, you know, get interested in this market from an OEM perspective. Now, Microsoft's way ahead of Apple, I think, in this arena. They have had a lock on the 10-foot interface for a while, I think.
Yeah, they've had XBMC for...
XBMC?
Xbox Media Center.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, they've got Xbox Media Center.
Oh, you were talking about, like, the Windows.
Yeah, but then there's Windows Media Center. Yeah. And I don't know if anyone's used Windows Media Center. It's awesome. I mean, it's a really, really slick interface. In Windows 7, they opened up a lot of, let's rewind a little bit. So one of the things that relegated the Apple TV to hobby status, and I think Steve Jobs admitted this to himself, is the proprietary and tightly controlled standards that the cable industry uses, and the digital satellite companies. digital satellite uses modulation called 8VSB. It's a digital sideband. And the digital cable uses a modulation called QAM, which stands for quadrature amplitude modulation. The standards are incompatible. The cards are really expensive, or were for a long time. The cards have come down in price. But on top of all that modulation stuff, there's also encryption. So the way that the cable company prevents you from seeing certain digital channels, such as like Showtime HD, HBO HD.
The pay channels.
The pay channels, or even like Noggin, like some of the, you know, and like Nicktoons and all these like extended digital channels that are up higher, like National Geographic, like...
Anything not in your tier.
Yeah, anything not in your tier, exactly. Good way of putting it. The way they control that is through encryption. They encrypt the QAM channels, and when you order the package, they send down the keys to your set-top box, then your set-top box is able to unencrypt those QAM signals. So getting back to HTPC. So the biggest roadblock to HTPCs have been the ability to record the digital channels, specifically the encrypted ones. So the first step was getting tuners that were QAM compatible. And if you're in the satellite world, 8VSB compatible, which good luck. I don't think it's ever going to happen. So once you get the QAM tuners, then you can tune the QAM channels, but then you need to decode them. So for a while, it's still around, there's a standard called cable card. And the FCC mandated that the cable companies and the cable box providers had to support this standard called cable card. It allowed them to store the keys on a device that they controlled so that you couldn't like break the encryption. And then there were going to be third-party devices that supported these that would be able to be hooked to other third-party devices like computers, you know, non-proprietary set-top boxes, whatever. And this was all going to be hunky-dory. You'd get these devices, you'd get the cable card from your cable company, they'd download the keys, and you'd be able to see the encrypted channels. Well, guess what? It never worked. It never worked properly. And beyond that, the Doxis, the company, or the cable standards group, made it such a pain in the butt to get these things. You had to have these specially built tuners that were certified by the cable labs. I'm sorry, not Doxis. It's Cable Labs. I'm sorry. Cable Labs. They had to be Cable Lab certified pieces of equipment. They had to hook to a computer that was Cable Lab certified, which meant that it had some kind of special BIOS in it with this flag set that it was Cable Lab certified, blah, 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 blah. And this is how you used to have to do it. And this is what relegated Apple TV to hobby status, because Steve Jobs didn't want to have to deal with it.
Kind of like what he's doing now with Blu-ray. He's like, this is too much proprietary stuff. We are not getting into it.
Yeah, he's got a point, you know, in some respects. But Microsoft has been fighting the battle on this one. They were able to, back when Vista came out, the media center upgrade included QAM support, which is a huge step forward, because now you could get those QAM channels, those digital channels I was talking about before. And if you want to do the encrypted stuff, you could, but you had to have a PC that was built by Cable Lab certified people and blah, blah, blah. Well, now in Windows 7, you don't need any of that. They relax the standards. All you need is a tuner that's cable card certified. It doesn't have to be a special one. You don't have to buy it from a pre-approved vendor. You don't need a special computer. You can just plug it into any old Windows 7 capable computer that has a PCI or PCI Express slot. You can even do USB, whatever. Doesn't matter. It works. Now, they fought the battle, and I think Apple might be trying to clinch on the...
They're reaping the benefits.
Yeah, they may reap the benefits because of this, because they've got this like small, compact device. I still think price-wise, it's not even the ballpark of a Windows home theater PC, especially considering you're not getting tuners for that price. I know myself, I built a HTPC about 2 years ago, and I didn't spend anywhere near that. Well, maybe around, right around that, but we're talking 2 years ago, you know, so.
Yeah.
It would crush this thing in functionality.
Right.
So, you know, I have a DVD drive, in mine, or Blu-ray. It has, I can run anything I want on. I guess this is not, it's not Apple TV anymore. Now it's running iOS or Mac OS X.
Yeah, it's running the full Mac operating system.
So it's a little more full featured. But mine, for that price, you know, I got a remote with mine.
And like you just said, you got a Blu-ray drive,
yeah,
which Apple will never in the near future have.
Yeah, I don't know why they're being this crabby about it, to be quite honest. I mean, maybe Steve Jobs just thinks that, you know, optical media is going to go the way of the VHS tape. And I kind of agree. I think Blu-ray was kind of dead in the water in comparison to DVD, in the sense that online downloads are going to be way more prolific in 5 to 10 years.
I want that to be the case, but I also need an internet connection greater than, you know, 10 megabits, because I have a 1080p TV. I can tell the difference when I'm watching a 720p show. I do not think it looks good. I do not want to watch things that are 720p. All high-def downloads from the internet now are 720p. So, I mean, until the internet connections get high enough that you can get 1080p downloads, you know, I want to believe him that digital downloads are the way to go, but not yet.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, he you know, it's one of those things, he may be just preparing the flock to move this direction now.
Yeah, and he does do that. You know, he's done that before. He's, you know, said, this is the popular thing now. We're not going to use it because I know that in a year it's going to go away. Yeah. So, you know, maybe he's doing it again.
So.
Yeah, but either way, you know, if you have an Apple TV, good luck getting support for that. You know, just buy a new Mac Mini. So, last thing that I wanted to talk about in regards to Apple is kind of what I just went through a little bit last Tuesday, and what other people went through a lot more. And for those of you who don't know, last Tuesday was the day that the new iPhone 4 became available for pre-order. Now, they learned their lesson before, and they opened up some more ways that you can get it. So you don't have to do it all online. You don't have to do it only at a store. You can do it, you know, either way. You can go to an Apple store. You can go to an AT&T store. You can go to store.apple.com. You can go to AT&T's wireless store. You know, however you want to do it, however you want to find this phone, you can go there and pre-order it. However, Tuesday became the day that the biggest mob of people ordered a device in the history of the world. Literally, I'm not joking about that. Go find articles that put out the stats. Literally the largest number of people went to order the new iPhone than any company has ever seen before for any device, any product. And because of that, all of the ways to order this went down. You couldn't order it on AT&T's website. You couldn't do it on Apple's website. If you went to a store, good luck waiting in line for 3 hours. You know, I tried to do it. I got mine pre-ordered, and I got it pre-ordered on Tuesday, so I was one of the lucky ones. I spent all morning trying to do it on AT&T's website, and then I said, you know, forget about this. I'm going to Pizza Day up in Richland, and the Galleria is right there with an AT&T store, so I will stop over there after Pizza Day and see if I can pre-order it there. Well, I went in, and even their systems were down. I thought, you know, this is an AT&T store. They would have some sort of, you know, Black Ops, you know, style network system that they could do the orders, even though us little people with the internet couldn't. They couldn't do it. Their stuff was all down. They had to do pen and paper order with me, you know, scan my credit card with one of those freaking chink chink machines. You know, so it was Stone Age to order this thing, but I got it ordered. And, you know, if you think my ordeal was bad, some people waited in line for 3 hours. Some people got theirs pre-ordered and then the next day got an email that theirs was canceled because they couldn't fulfill all of the orders. And now those people have to wait until July to get the iPhone 4. So basically, if you didn't get your phone ordered on that Tuesday, you are now waiting until July to get your iPhone 4 because they cannot meet demand. Even though they knew it was going to be huge, they didn't realize it was going to be this huge. So what do you think, Ryan?
Honestly, I only have one thing to say about this. Boo-hoo-hoo, I can't get my iPhone 4. Here's my advice to you. If your order got canceled, wait like a year until the 4GS comes out, because you're going to want it anyways. And just,
oh yeah, every year there's going to be a new one. You know that.
So that's my advice.
Yeah, I was hoping, you know, we could talk a little more about, you know, they're preparing for the network storm. you know, not so much more bashing of Apple.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, I don't really feel bad, because I think there's this like sense of entitlement that, you know, everyone deserves to get their iPhone on day one or whatever. And I don't know. I've never been that way about any device. Like, I'm typically a wait and see type person. You know, I hype things up a little bit here and there. When I see some reports, I remember when the Palm Pre came out, it looked pretty cool. I was like, hey, that's a pretty cool device. And then they said it was only going to be on Sprint. And I said, so what? You know, and there was a lot of things like that. You know, the first Droid, the Droid Incredible, the Droid, the Motorola Droid, the BlackBerry Tour. You know, they've all been like, they're all hyped up and everyone thought they're going to be great. And the iPhone always delivers on that. I guess, I don't know if it delivers, I'm not saying it delivers on being great. I think it delivers on the hype, in the sense that people buy into it. But, you know, I don't really feel sorry for folks that don't get their way on day one.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad for some people, you know, especially those people who waited in line, you know, outside of a store for however many hours. Yes, it was their own stupidity for doing that. But still, you know, they were told, you know, by Apple, by AT&T, by everybody that, you know, we know the storm of people is going to be huge. We have prepared for it. We learned our lesson with the 3GS. We learned our lesson with the 3G. We learned our lesson with the original iPhone. And with the iPhone 4, it just goes to show you they did not learn their lesson, or at least they did not learn it enough, because everything broke. But either way, I am happy to announce that I think my iPhone is going to get here a day early. The iPhones are not supposed to arrive in people's hands until the 24th, Thursday, but I checked my FedEx tracking number. It's in Memphis, Tennessee at lunchtime today, set for a delivery tomorrow. I'm staying home from work so that I can be here to sign for it, because they used freaking FedEx, and freaking FedEx makes you sign your freaking signature for everything. I hate FedEx, if you can't tell. Like, just drop the stuff on my porch. Nobody's going to steal it, seriously. But yeah, so I'm excited, and all of you who are getting iPhone 4s are excited. I know you are. I can feel your excitement already. Ryan's not excited.
No, I'm not excited. I'm not excited, not in the least.
Okay, so
actually, maybe a little bit of excitement. Maybe like some excitement that like when they come, they won't power on.
Oh,
and or man, like there'll be some massive bug that like, I don't know, it
shocks my hand.
Reroutes all your traffic to some like Chinese hacker.
Dude,
that'd be pretty cool.
If Kim Jong Il gets my data, you're really brushing my balls here, Hanj. Okay, so do you have anything else to add on anything? Anything cool that you saw over the past couple of weeks?
Actually, there's one thing I noticed. I saw an article. I think it was on, I want to say Gizmodo. Can't remember exactly. There's this cool technology making batteries out of potatoes. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. Explain.
Yeah, I think some Israeli university did a study on or some kind of like, I don't know what it was, experiment with potatoes. They found that if they boiled the potatoes a certain way, they could get a tenfold increase. I mean, everyone's made potato batteries.
Well, yeah.
They got a tenfold increase out of these batteries using just like a copper and a zinc electrode. And the things will run for several days to weeks and produce 10 times the amount of power that a normal potato battery would.
That
was pretty cool. And they're going to give the method of doing it out for free, so third world countries can use it to make some batteries to run their portable devices.
If you see me with a potato taped to my iPhone, you know why. I need the battery life.
Ice bud.
Call Steve Jobs. Hurry up. Get in on that. You can make some money.
I got prior art. Ha ha ha.
All right. So that is it for this episode of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook. My username is Slongcack. You can find Ryan on Twitter and Facebook. His username is Ryan Lancey. And he just knocked over my music stand with all of my music on it. So that's okay. I have a small studio.
Sorry.
So have a great night, everybody.